without further ado, let's move into a short story she wrote, the most famous short story of her oeuvre, which is...
The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And
great title.
It is, yeah. And we're going
What is it about The Ones Who Walk Away that's particularly interesting?
Well, so The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, it's an in media res story about a utopian-style town who are engaging in festivities, and so... After the broader picture of this town, she zooms in on one particular room. So I've got a couple of little bits here. In the description of this hangout, there is a source, and I can sum it up with a brilliant tweet chain here where one guy who got a fair number of likes on Twitter said, we should just pin all the debt in the world on one guy and then kill him, to which someone said, I think you just invented Christianity. And Le Guin's morality in this is kind of the inverse of that, and so she focuses on the ones who walk away from Omelas as being the only moral people for conscientiously objecting to individual suffering in the benefit for the benefits of the collective.
So just to recap this, and the Society of Omelas, it features this one kind of scapegoat character that the whole society revolves around.
Yes, and it's a brutalized child, so she really hammers it home. So she opens with saying her source of inspiration for this story was the American psychologist William James. Or if the hypothesis were offered us of a world in which Messrs. Fourier's and Bellamy's, Edward Bellamy, looking backwards, I believe it's 1884 to 2004, it was a guy falls asleep and dreams of a socialist paradise. If all of those and things were realized, millions should be kept permanently happy on the one simple condition that a certain lost soul on the far-off edge of things should leave a life of lonely torment. What except a specificial and independent sort of emotion can it be which would make us immediately feel, even though an impulse arose within us to clutch at happiness so offered, how hideous a thing would be its enjoyment when deliberately accepted as the fruit of such a bargain? Basically, can we suffer the suffering? Can we, our consciences, bear the suffering of one individual person that we don't know, hypothetically, off somewhere for our own collective utopian benefit?
So there's a moral question being posed. Yes. Is it okay for the many to prosper on the condition that a small minority, in this case, even one person, must suffer systemically?
Yeah, and she actually, I'm glad you said systemically, because she said directly after this quote, embedding it in her work, the dilemma of the American conscience could hardly be better stated. She was saying that America itself as a civilization was prospering at the expense of around the world. You have this kind of, I'm not going to call her a Leninist, but it is the postmodern new leftist belief in how imperialism, environmental extraction works, as to where one nation, at the expense of all others, in a zero-sum game, extracts the wealth of another country and prospers itself. And she does set up Omelas in her text as America prospering at the expense of other nations. But I think if you take it out of its national context, it's a much broader, more intelligent thought experiment to say only people who refute utilitarianism and conscientiously object and say people have inviolable individual rights can be moral. It opens with saying that in Omelas, they did not use swords, they did not keep slaves, they were not barbarians. I do not know the laws and rules of their society, but I suspect that they were singularly few. As they did without monarchy and slavery, they also got on without the stock exchange, the advertisement, the secret police, and the bomb. Yet I repeat, these were not simple folk, not dulcet shepherds, noble savages, bland utopians. They were less complex than us. The trouble is that we have a bad habit, encouraged by pedants and sophistries, of considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. This is the treason of the artist, a refusal to admit the banality of evil and the terrible boredom of pain. And I think that's very much the idea that there is only suffering can bring forward true art.
Right.
And so she's saying that I'm dreaming of this utopian conception and I reject the idea that suffering either inflicted upon us or internalized is somehow a utilitarian excuse for saying, but it will produce something beautiful at the end of it. Instead, we should aim for the good and still believe in ourselves being able to produce solid art after that, because she clearly contends in a lot of her works with the striving for utopia.
Yes, but I think it is natural to see this production of art out of suffering, because it's a lot of art exists in that space between contentment and discontentment, and it seems like the natural counter-dialectic to any sort of set environment is this understanding of the flaws, of the dark side, so to speak. And I think that is an immensely prolific source of ideas.
I agree with that.
And ways of exploring the complications, and there are many, of our settled understanding.
And I think that actually links a little bit, fact that you said dark side, to her Taoist beliefs, which we'll come on to soon, because she did a translation of the Tao Te Ching, in which it's an existential outgrowth of existence that suffering will inevitably happen, and therefore make art from the inevitable suffering you encounter, mm-hmm. rather than actively inflicting it to get a good product out of it. And this is what this is about.
Yeah.
Because then...
Yeah, if you think about it, the idea of, okay, let's suppose we have a guild of artists, right? We lock them up, we torture them 3 times a week, and then we see what, like literally torture them and see what they produce, is somewhat ethically problematic, wouldn't you say?
Well, this is exactly what she does in this. Right, okay. So it's... I'm chopped up the quotes a little bit, but mm-hmm. I'm going to make sure it's not too long. In a basement under one of the beautiful buildings of Omelas, or perhaps in a cellar of one of its spacious private homes, there is a room. It has one locked door and no window. In the room, a child is suffering. It could be a boy or a girl. It looks about 6, but is actually nearly 10. It is feeble-minded. Perhaps it was born defective, or perhaps it has become imbecile through fear, manipulation, and neglect. The people at the door never say anything, but the child, who has not always lived in the room and can remember sunlight and its mother's voice, sometimes speaks. "I will be good," it says. "Please let me out. I will be good." They never answer. The child used to scream for help at night and cry a good deal, but now only makes a kind of whining. They all know it is there, all the people of Omelas. Some of the people have come to see it, others content merely to know it is there. They all know that it has to be there. Some of them understand why, and some do not. But they all understand that the happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of their friendships, the health of their children, the wisdom of their scholars, the skill of their makers, even the abundance of their harvest and the kindly weathers of their skies depend wholly on this child's abominable misery. They know that they, like the child, are not free. They know compassion. It is the existence of the child and their knowledge of its existence that makes possible the nobility of their architecture, the poignancy of their music, the profundity of their science. And so what she's saying is each person has to reconcile, countenance, the fact that somehow their prosperity is at the expense of another. Mm. However, this, even though the magical logistics aren't quite explained, because how can one child's suffering produce the prosperity of one city? Mm-hmm. It sets up the utilitarian dichotomy of where if you have the knowledge, can you ever be moral if you're prosperous, if you're subjectively ignorant to one person suffering at the benefit of others? Mm-hmm. And so because there's a hidden hand doing this, rather than just saying, oh, art is produced for existential suffering, it would be like your example of art is produced because we lock people in a box and torture them and hopefully something beautiful comes of it. So then her refutation of utilitarianism comes from this, and she says, at times one of the adolescent boys or girls who will go to see the child, almost like a rite of passage, a moral awakening to become an adult, does not go home to weep or rage, does not in fact go home at all. Sometimes also a man or woman much older falls silent for a day or two and then leaves home. These people go out into the street and walk down the street alone. They keep walking and walk straight out of the city of Omelas through the beautiful gates. They keep walking across the farmlands of Omelas. They go on, they leave Omelas. They walk into the darkness and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the City of Happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist, but they seem to know where they are going, the ones who walk away from Omelas. Mm. And it's saying that you can have your head held high if you object to this individual instance of suffering, even if you believe in the city that is built on that one instance of suffering, mm-hmm. is heaven itself. Mm. You can't build a Tower of Babel up to heaven stacked on corpses, essentially.
Well, this is a really interesting one, and it ties in very strongly with her Taoist beliefs, because if you think about it, what Omelas is, if you know the yin-yang symbol, so you have the white and the black, well, the city of Omelas is represented as the white tear in that. But of course, the fundamental thing of the yin-yang symbol is that within that tear you have the one speck of darkness to prove that in light itself there is always darkness, and in darkness there is always light. And you can see, like, the characters from this story making this journey, that they are brought up in the white and then they are taken to see the speck of darkness, then they walk away into the shadow after that, leaving the city entirely.
Well, the etymology of the word Omelas is actually kind of interesting, mm-hmm. with that, because she'd read a road sign for Salem and then O for Oregon, where she lives, backwards, and so she just did that. But then she said, retroactively, it not only sounds like home at last, but also Salim, as in another word for peace. And so you have contained within that the inherent contradiction that to achieve peace you must inflict suffering.
Mm.
And therefore, that also links to her Taoist beliefs, because she did the translation of the Tao Te Ching. I think it's worth saying that if you want a more in-depth coverage of this, I know Hugo and Josh did a Contemplations on this. I believe it was number 19.
Okay.
You might correct me, but should be able to go find that. Mm. But it's actually worth talking about some of that translation, I would say. I've picked a couple of quotes from this, okay. and we can dissect. Just a brief overview, the Tao Te Ching was made around 400 BCE. Lao Tzu is presumed to be the person who published it, but obviously it might be a pseudonym, it might be a group of writers. It's the Chinese character for Dao, so it's broken into three strokes. There's the yin and yang, as you said, with this famous symbol. Then there's the shu, this sort of ladder-looking part in the middle, which means oneself. That means these internal contradictions about the world, the natural order, are contained within yourself. And then there's also the chao, the L at the base. That means to go, to move, to act. And it's strange how that part is in it, because it's almost instructing you to not necessarily proactively act, but there's a phrase of almost go with the flow. I heard someone describe it once as like Confucianism and Western thought is like rowing, whereas Taoism is more like sailing, because you're using the natural winds of the current to push you along.
Well, I think there's the whole story about damming the river, isn't there? And it's more about letting the river go where it wants to and moving around that rather than trying to dam the river, which is often seen as silly. So why are they damned anyway?
Well, no, I was going to say that's actually fairly relevant, because the reason for the damming in China, the massive erection of the infrastructure, was actually Mao a lot of the time, and he used Taoism as he combined it with Confucianism. There was a contradiction there, but that was part of his dialectical belief. He used the inherent contradictions in Taoism to sort of Trojan horse in Leninism, because Lenin and Marx said everything contains its contradictions, and if you accelerated the contradictions, then you accelerate the demise of capitalism. So using ancient Chinese philosophy, they repackaged Marxism and then used a Confucian proactivity to then accelerate the dialectic. I know it's a bit of a strange point, but
interesting.
There's actually a paper in the description that you can read on this, because I found an interesting quote from it, which is Chinese logic is a logic of correlative duality, and being at peace with not being able to fully reconcile these contradictions in a rationalist way seems to be the more passive approach that Taoism produces, and some of actually Le Guin's heroes and heroines have the idea.
Yes, we'll certainly discuss that more as we get into it.
Yes, so just a couple of short quotes. Everybody on earth knowing that beauty is beautiful makes ugliness. Everybody knowing that goodness is good makes wickedness. For being and non-being arise together, hard and easy, complete each other. Long and short shape each other. High and low depend on each other. Note and voice make the music together. Before and after follow each other. That's why the wise soul does without doing. True goodness is like water. Water's good for everything. It doesn't compete. It goes right. To flow to the loathsome places, and so it finds the way. And then there's the contrast as to where if you try and proactively work, you will overexert yourself and fail. Brim fill the bowl. It'll spill over. Keep sharpening the blade. You'll soon blunt it. Nobody can protect a house full of gold and jade. Wealth, status, pride are their own ruin. To do good, work well, and lie low is the way of the blessing. And that's why they have this idea of, they spell it P-U, but it's the idea of uncut wood. So if you don't fashion yourself in one particular direction, you are not susceptible to the imperfections and potential failures, whereas if you maintain natural order, it can continue to grow and flourish as it should. And so that sort of passive but naturally congruent outlook is how a lot of Le Guin's heroes act. But I did want to bring in something quite interesting from our biography. And that is, if the independent child suffering cannot justify a personal prosperity, and if you're meant to follow the natural order, then Le Guin's own politics and personal life don't quite gel with that, because she gave a interview with The Nation in which she said about how at 19 she got an illegal abortion in New York. So quite literally, one unborn child suffering allowed her career to prosper. And in that interview, she turns around and said, but if I hadn't have had that abortion, I wouldn't have met my husband, I wouldn't have my kids, I wouldn't have my writing career. So that is utilitarianism in her own life.
Well, in retroactive utilitarianism.
Well, yes.
But does, in that interview, does she consider the child who she aborted as a human being?
She doesn't say that.
Exactly.
But that doesn't add up. Mm-hmm. And it's also against the natural order. And it's also against she self-identifies as Buddhist, and there's at least a contention within the Buddhist tradition as to whether or not abortion is valid. Mm-hmm. But the Buddhist tradition that does validate abortion says it's okay because you'll be reincarnated anyway, which again is a utilitarian justification. Whereas the Buddhist tradition, which says that each life is inviolable, believes life starts at conception. Mm-hmm. So she at least has a philosophical inconsistency within her framework, which is why, as I've said to you before, and you've introduced her with glowing praise as saying her politics doesn't necessarily affect her work, I agree. I'm going to be a bit harsh and say she's an accidental genius.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.